You're right.
Thank you. Got it.
My name is Dave, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
Some of you don't know me. That's a picture of my son that we lost a couple of years ago.
Love you, Dave.
Thank you. I love you, Nick. I miss you, Nick. I want to thank Sue and the committee for asking Denise and I to do this, because I know many of you are healing the same way I'm trying to. I was reminiscing when I walked in here last night. When I came to California 36 years ago, I was a drug and alcohol counselor. I was a little hot shot. You know, I had all the answers. And I loved doing that. I did it with a lot of passion. And I walk in here last night, and I see Jason, who I thought was dead. I thought we'd lost him years ago. And my friend Brian Scott, who knew me. Both of these guys knew me 36 years ago. I was 31 years old. I didn't have a gray hair on my head. I had a 30-inch waist. I was shitting and getting. And, you know, my recovery has been a hell of a journey. And one of the things today, this picture came up on my Facebook feed this past week. And it just... I couldn't contain my grief that Nick was such a special kid. He had such energy. What I admired about him, his phone always rang. That kid was always talking to someone, you know? And I don't know what to say to my AA friends and associates in the program, giving me the best 10 years of my life. That I've been, you know, it's funny. I met somebody this past month who didn't realize I was sober. They knew me more from my Al-Anon involvement, and they were surprised that I was in recovery. And, you know, briefly to get into that, I'm Irish. I come from a long line of drunks. My maternal grandfather died from alcoholism at 56. He took a fall and bled out. So my mother came from alcoholism. My father came from poverty and death. His dad died when he was 9, and that is something I'm learning to understand as I try to grieve the loss of my son, understanding what a difficult and confusing emotion grief can be. So, you know, my story, and a really brief thing, because, you know, how I got here, it seems so ancient. I've been sober since November the 16th of 82, so I've been around for a while, you know. So, and, you know, there was a time I really didn't acknowledge what a miracle that is, and I don't make that mistake anymore. That's a miracle, even with all the ups and downs, all the dryness, all the difficulties, all the mistakes, all that stuff. It's still a miracle that I've been here for that many days in a row. And if you heard Ricky speak last night, I thought she did a great job of talking about the family disease of alcoholism with her father being so devastated. And so I'll just get into it real quickly. Richard Pryor, 1980, starts himself on fire. My reaction to this is not, oh, that poor guy. My reaction is, what's Freebase? 2 weeks, I was cooking it. I knew how to shake it and squirt it. Fast forward 2.5 years. That's how long it took me to plummet to a bottom. And November of 1982, this amazing man that I worked with, because my family could never get me sober. They could never get my attention. But a job and a job loss, that got my attention. And I went to rehab, and I heard the idea of try this for a year. And if you don't like the results at the end of a year, go back to the way it was. And I approached my sobriety that way. And I remember in rehab, everybody was going to be sober, and we were going to do this, and I was so dismayed that by the time I got to 6 months, there was only a handful of us, you know, left that were still doing the deal. And I'm so glad that I made a full decision to give it a full effort. And I was like Mr. AA. I called myself the chairman of AA because I like getting there early and setting up chairs. I still like doing that. My favorite job in AA service thing has always been to be a greeter. I love meeting somebody, especially parents that are coming to their first Al-Anon meeting. Or, you know, we had a young lady in my AA home group that came to her one of her first meetings on Wednesday night, and it's just magic to meet people when they're new. And I got sober in Pennsylvania. Denise and I moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma when I had a few years of sobriety, and that's where I started my little drug counseling career, my little savior career, my little angel career. I was going to save the world, and I was pretty good at it. I liked it a lot until, you know, it's never a career that's going to pay a whole lot of money. And when you have a couple of kids, you know, I needed to change my focus and do some other things. So my early AA sobriety could be sized up like this. 90 meetings in 90 days worked so well for me that I did 10 years of meetings in 10 years. I averaged a meeting a day for a decade. And then when I moved to California, and I like to talk about this because it's only in hindsight that I realized how difficult moving was for me. That when I made the move from Tulsa, Oklahoma to here, I didn't land in stride. I didn't land in stride at all. With my career in counseling, I was really isolated. I had no support around me. I remember getting assaulted by a kid. And I wanted to have him arrested, and my boss is like, no, you can't do that. It would upset the parents. And it's like, I look back on that, how naive I was. And some things happened, and I remember I got cross-talked at a meeting. I had 13 years of sobriety. I was at 454 North Indian, if you ever remember that room upstairs. And a guy cross-talked me and criticized something I said, and I just said, you know, forget this. I don't need AA anymore. And I went on a dry spell, and a dry spell lasted almost a decade. And many of you heard my story. Alcoholics cannot have emergencies during regular business hours. So I was used to being woken up in the middle of the night by the local police telling me something that my son did. And this one evening, my son was involved in a car accident. And mind you, he did not have a driver's license. And of course, he had no permission to drive my car, but he told me he did the army crawl. And I sleep like a log. He could have walked in with tambourines and I wouldn't have woke up. He stole my keys. He went out in the car. And we get to the scene of the crime, and I'm pretty optimistic because the car doesn't look like it's too bad. You know, he didn't steal the clunker. Right? He stole the good car. We had a good car and a bad car. He stole the good car. And I walked around the other side of the car, and you remember in Back to the Future, the wheels would fold up? You know, it'd fold up and go away. Well, Nick folded the wheels underneath the car. I remember that night, I raged. I would be embarrassed for any of you to see how I behaved that night. And, you know, it was the only time Nick ever did something where he didn't get arrested. I remember he got arrested for stealing a Slim Jim at AM, PM, and it was a felony probation violation. He went to jail for a Slim Jim, but he stole my freaking car and they sent him home with me. And I think the cops were going home with this guy is punishment enough for anybody. You know, because I was raging. And at that point, a drink sounded like a really good idea because I didn't know what to do. This kid that I loved so much, I was losing him. He was young, and I was in deep denial. I had no idea the depths of his addiction. I thought he was like me. He was smoking pot and drinking. And he was into much harder drugs than I realized. And I remember, has anybody ever been to the Dirty Dozen at the Alano Club? You'd have to have been around a long time. They used to be a really big meeting. Yeah. So this was a meeting. It wasn't uncommon if a fight would break out, you know, because somebody said marijuana or something and the whole fight would start. You know, you young guys, it's so cool that AA has progressed and changed a bit. I remember being at meetings. The whole thing would have been, you have to take your hat off. You know, like it would be like about Trevor, some old timer would be like, we're not starting the meeting until you take your hat off, young man, and that kind of stuff. It was just like, I'm glad things have evolved. I told you I stopped in Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you swore in Tulsa, the meeting would stop. Some guy would go, excuse me, young man, but this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we just don't talk that way around here. And I went from that to the Dirty Dozen. And the Dirty Dozen was different. And anyway, so that was my involvement. That was 17, 18 years ago. I have had continuous involvement in recovery. What I realize in hindsight as I look back on that, I was sicker dry than I ever was wet. I was sicker from not treating my alcoholism, although I wasn't drinking, I was sicker dry than I was wet. And I was in more pain because this family disease and the addiction my boy had took me to darker places than I have ever been before. More desperate. When I read the big book and it talks about the four horsemen, the one that gets me is bewilderment. I was one, when I was using, I would clean my act up for a while, get myself out of trouble, fall. Clean myself up for a while, get back into trouble, fall. And bewilderment was always the feeling, like, how did I let this happen again? I thought selective drug use would be my answer if I just didn't do this or I didn't do that. And I'm so grateful that, again, full effort, man. That first year was so critical to me to get that underneath my belt. I still think the most miraculous chip I ever took was a 30-day chip because it just took some willingness. In treatment, the only thing I remember is the Serenity Prayer. Somebody did a lecture on the Serenity Prayer, and they talked about JFK's mom losing three kids. And she said, I can't change the circumstances in my life. I can only change my reactions to them. And that just stuck with me. So that prayer, I'm a good Catholic boy. So prayer has always been a very important part of my life. I find prayer very soothing and calming. Although I prayed my ass off this morning and I could not calm my emotions. I haven't done this since we lost Nick. And so what I like about having his ashes, his remains in an urn, it's a symbol of my grief. I have to do that. I have to keep Nick in a really special place. Because if I let him out at the wrong time, this happens. But this is the right place for that. Because I know, like I look at Bridget, and Bridget was there at the very beginning, and we lost Mike. And I think probably Mike Brown and Nick Flagg, with a lot of others, are looking down on us tonight, and they're with us here. And I know a lot of you feel, Nick. I think part of maybe why I was asked, I don't know if I'm right, Sue, it's just like, you guys need to know that we're okay. You know, this is where I met Baxter. We have mixed up. I met him here. Trevor put up a post this morning on Facebook about this is the first Mad Dog Days Without Nick. And I met Baxter here. You know, we have his Frenchie now. He's in honor of Nick, he's the world's neediest dog. So it's really apropos that we have him. And that's a whole separate story. You know, Denise and I have been through some ups and downs. And I love this woman so much. As an alcoholic, you know, when I hear, what's the term? An emotionally unavailable man. Every time I hear that, I feel like I should put my hand up. You know, like, you know, partly that's me. And I know me being married to an alcoholic, and we're typically, as we learn in the book, that we're very sensitive. Yeah, we're very sensitive. The family afterwards, it's a short sentence, that we're sensitive, and myself, I'm immature. So I feel that my recovery can be defined in one word, and that is maturity. And Denise and I, like I say, we've been through some ups and downs. You know, we got married in Tulsa. There was no family at our wedding. It was a little small, like, potluck event. It was really cool. And it was. I worked for this little drug abuse program, and the parents did this thing, and we had this cool little event. We got married, and, you know, along came Brady, and then along came Nick. My memories of Nick are so fond because, like, the day it started, Denise's gynecologist was a dick. He was just this impatient guy. He was just this impatient guy until game day. And then on game day, this completely different person shows up. And he coaches Denise to lean forward and pull Nick out of her body and place him on her chest. So, like, that's the image I have. That's how Nick's beautiful life began, with this beautiful woman. And, you know, although we lost Nick physically, he is here with me. God, I feel him all the time. You know, I know I'm all over the place, guys. This is just, like, the best I can do today. So, without Al-Anon, without AA, you know, Donnie Moore's here. Donnie and I have been in a men's group, an Al-Anon men's group, for 17 years, reading the same damn book. And if you've ever gone through the same book, because in 17 years, we went through it 17 times because we do a step a month. And it amazes me how the words change every time we go through it. And words that weren't there are now there. So it's just, it's really cool to be that connected to something. You know, with Donnie, when he lost his wife, we were there for him. Members of our group have passed on. If any of you remember Recovered Jim, Dick McKinley, Dr. Dick, the Dick Doctor. That's his introduction, not mine. He was a brilliant guy, and he had a sense of humor. Dick's up at that meeting, too. But, you know, my Al-Anon recovery has been so important to me. Without my sobriety, I have nothing. But on this parallel track, I have this Al-Anon recovery that has brought me understanding that I never got anywhere else. And I'm very, very grateful. I'm very grateful to both of the programs. But Denise and I's journey together has been in the Al-Anon program. And you can imagine, you know, the strain of losing a kid. It's horrible. You know, what I almost feel guilty about at times is that I didn't realize how much anxiety I had every day in my life when my kid was out there. I don't care if he was sober or not sober. The level of anxiety that I had in my life that I didn't realize, really, until Nick was gone, I realized how much anxiety I was always carrying. It was mind-boggling for me to realize how much was there. Debbie Vogel was a literature person at our Tuesday night meeting. And this one night, she opened a book. It's called Transforming Our Losses. And this is long before we lost Nick. But she introduced me to this term. The literature person at our meeting would read a paragraph from a book. So she opens this book to page 28, I know now. And the heading of the paragraph or the writing is anticipatory grief. She didn't have to go beyond those two words for me to identify what I had been suffering from for a decade. Anticipatory grief, expecting that phone call, expecting that whatever. If you ever want to mess with an Al-Anon, Call them at 11 o'clock at night. I have never got a good phone call past 9 o'clock in the evening. If you want to mess with an Al-Anon, like I say, call them late at night. They will answer the phone in panic. And they will not go back to sleep, even if you just call to say hello. So, I owe my life to AA. I owe my marriage and my life to Al-Anon. Where do I go from here? 50 to 60 was the best decade of my life so far. It was awesome. I was super fit. If you remember, I did the CrossFit stuff, and I, did these competitions, and I just did all this wacky, like, alcoholic stuff, man. I'm all in. And, here I am. I'm 67 years old. I got sober at 25. So you newcomers, I know a couple of you put your hands up. Relapse doesn't have to be a part of your story. I got this from the very beginning, from being willing. And even when I got lost, that real decision to give this a full effort has paid off for me. So even in my dry times, I never felt, compelled that using a substance could make anything in my life any better. And if I have a theme for my life to explain my recovery, it would be from survival to recovery. I grew up in a pretty abusive home. I was the youngest of four boys. There was an 8-year difference between the two. So I was playing sports against kids 8 years older than me. I never had a chance, but I never wanted to let them see how afraid I was. And one of my things about all the trauma in my life, I always go, it wasn't that bad. And it's true, it wasn't that bad in comparison to some other people, but it still had a profound effect on my life. And, one of my friends that I really like gave me a definition of the spiritual malady that I really like. I hear that term a lot. That's what Bill called our thing. He didn't use the word disease, I guess. But the spiritual malady I heard defined as when how I feel on the inside doesn't match how I act on the outside. And me, see, I'm always trying to be that guy, that high energy guy. And sometimes on the inside, I'm dying. I'm dying. And for me, I've said this a lot, some of the most important words that I hear at almost every AA meeting and how it works is our personal adventures before and after. So I need to hear and after. Because when I got here, I thought all I was doing was cleaning up the mess of what happened to get me to where I was. But really, the challenge is to live by the principles defined in the program to the best of my ability is the after. And if I do that well, that probably means I got a pretty good chance and not taking a drink today. I always make a couple of notes, before I come in because I'm so scatterbrained. But in my early recovery, I healed the estrangement in my family. My father and I were estranged probably from the time I was 13, 14 years old. And when I went to treatment, we never said, I love you, and we never hugged. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the courage to do both of those things, to let it begin with me and to hug my father and say I love him. And that was magic. And I know part of the reason I find grief so hard to deal with, my dad lost his dad when he was 8 years old in the first year of the Depression. And he was the oldest, so I knew, what he heard. You're the man of the house now. And I had the privilege of doing some therapy with him. And when he talked about losing his dad, decades after it happened, it was when he talked about it, it was like it just happened a minute ago. So I know, how much he had repressed. And I just want to say this. I have a grief book, and
I think I'm running out of time, so this is perfect.
My grief may be in common, but it is private as well. No one can feel just as I feel, and I have what I need to see my way through this. If you, my friends, are with me, thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Let's give it up for him and the outfit. All right, please help me in welcoming our second speaker, Denise.
Hi, my name is Denise, and I am a grateful member of Al-Anon. And Dave and I are opposites. He's our emotional guy in the family, and I'm the stuffer. So I stuff things down. That's what I've always done. So I don't know when it comes out, where he allows it to come out. Mine comes out sideways in all different ways. I got real emotional just walking in here today, seeing people, because, again, the last time we were here, Nick was here. And, you know, I'm sorry to say that's part of our story. You know, isn't that every parent's worst nightmare is to lose their child? But, you know, we have to go on. And I will tell you, we are here today because of Al-Anon and AA. I could not have got through that without it. And I continue to go so that I can continue to go. I am very qualified to be an Al-Anon. And it's not, you know, I always feel when I go to meetings and AA meetings that, you know, they talk about the drinking. Well, you know what? Everything that goes on in my head is no different than his, and I don't drink. So that's what qualifies me to be here. I am the adult child of an alcoholic. I'm married an alcoholic, and I gave birth to alcoholics. By the grace of God, I'm on the other side. But the thinking between my head is no different. And I didn't learn that till I came to Al-Anon. I grew up in a home that from a divorced family back in that day. You know, you wouldn't think anything. My mother left my dad because he drank, and she left her two children with him. So when I look at my story, I have so many periods of grace that I was raised by an alcoholic in an alcoholic home, but I didn't know it. I mean, I really didn't know it until I came, you know, till we came here. And even marrying an alcoholic, and nobody told me about Al-Anon. It wasn't till our son, you know, got into trouble that somebody said, go to Al-Anon. And the first time I walked through a door, I actually cried. And I walked away, and all I thought was, oh, my God, I feel so much better. I can't explain the feeling of I felt better. Can't tell you why. I just know when I left there, I felt better. And I've continued to go since then. We disagree on how long it's been. All I know, it was a Tuesday night in October. I say 14 years, he says 15, you know. It was somewhere around there. But from the day I walked through those doors, I found that it was about me. See, I was an Al-Anon that did everything for you. I took care of everybody else. I was the overachiever. You know, if you wanted something done, I could get it done, and I could get the lists, and I was all that. And I was so immature. I was so immature. I met this man at 17 years old. He didn't go into all that. And my dad knew of him. And so I said to my dad, I met this guy, and he asked me out, and I said his name, and he goes, no. What he didn't tell you was his nickname was Flash. And he took me to a bar. And I was 17. And he took me to a really nice dive bar and left me at the bar and went and shot pool. But me, being an Al-Anon, I was just like, oh, this is so exciting for me. It was. It was very exciting. And we've kind of been together since then. And then, like he said, we have had ups and downs. And I truly believe that we are together because of Al-Anon. It's real easy to walk away when there's trouble. It's real easy to not communicate and talk. You know, I've learned through Al-Anon about intimacy, intimacy. I have conversations with Dave today that I would have never had. I always tell this little story because an Al-Anon will understand. So my brain makes up things. I think it, and it becomes real for me. I have emotions over a thought in my head. I mean, I can get worked up over nothing of reality, but just because I think it. This was years and years ago. I've gone from long hair, short hair, curly, straight, whatever, and I had cut my hair off really short. And I had always had short hair before. And I'd got new glasses the same time. And I had gone to work, and everybody was making, like, they didn't know who I was. And I had made a comment to him. I said, oh, my God, I shouldn't have cut my hair and this and that and my glasses. And all he said was, well, didn't they say you had 30 days to return your glasses? Very innocent comment, right? No. I hear, the glasses look horrible, your hair looks terrible, and we get into a fight. This is, again, before Al-Anon. I don't know this, you know. He leaves for work. Something's not done. We have a fight all day long in my head. He gets home, I'm pissed off, and he doesn't even know I've been fighting with him in my head all day. Understand, that's what I learn in Al-Anon. I am so grateful that I have a sponsor that has a sponsor, and people who know who my sponsor is. She is very black belt. My first sponsor was very caring, loving, and warm, and that's what I needed when I walked in the doors. And then I got to a point where I really wanted to work steps. You know, the difference I have found when I came in here and I found out all of a sudden it was all about me and taking care of me. And I always felt horrible at the beginning when I started to have some joy in my life, because I thought, as a parent, I'm not supposed to have joy. My son's out there in the streets. How can I have joy? And I realized that, you know, if I don't have joy, what do I have? You have to understand, when I came through the doors, well, I was younger, but I didn't, when I walked out there, nobody knew what was going on behind our doors. I made sure of that. I could fake it so well. And I would walk in the door and I would shut the door and fall to the floor. I grew up and all I thought was, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So in my mind, everything that was going on with my children was because of something I did, the way I raised them or something. And I had to learn that it wasn't me, it's their choices. It has been so difficult for me to understand that I have choices. And I am exactly where I choose to be. And I would be like, what do you mean? I didn't choose this. Well, you know what? Subconsciously or not, I have chosen every moment of my life to be there and whatever's going on. I have an opportunity every day to change my thinking, to reach out to somebody, to talk to them. I think the biggest thing in the program for me is that I don't have to do it alone, because I can do it. I don't need your help. I'm good, but I'm crumbling inside. I'm really good at comparing my insides to your outsides, and it's real easy on the outside to make everything look good. I think that's what I love about both of these programs, is we are allowed to be perfectly imperfect. Because I thought I had to be perfect for you to like me. I had to be perfect and say yes. Oh, my God, I can say no and you'll still like me. That was really difficult for me. And working steps with a sponsor who I've done multiple times, I can, you know, I get to continuously look at my part and what I've done. You know, when I even look at somebody says, well, what is my part with my child? Well, my part is, I was overbearing. You know, I didn't allow him to make mistakes. And as hard as it is as a parent, you've got to step away and let him make mistakes. Like even with us, I want to tell him what to do and how to do it. You know, who's to say what the way I do it is right? In my story, there's a lot of good and bad as far as growing up. You know, I was molested as a child by more than one person. And, you know, all that stuff sticks with you and growing up. And that's where in a relationship, it's really difficult. You know, I had difficulty, you know, having communication with Dave. And Al-Anon's taught me that it's okay for me to be uncomfortable and have conversations. And because if we don't talk, it's not going to work for us. When Nick passing, I think the fact that we were able to stay together and talk and be, you know, be with each other as a family, and the support that we got from Al-Anon and AA. Some of you were there. That his service, there was almost 600 people that came out, and all that did for me was let me know how loved we are and my children were. Somebody came up earlier and they said, "Oh, we thought of Nick." Oh, they didn't know if they should say anything. And to me, I want people to say something about him. I want them to say they remember them, because for me, I remember him every day. We think about him every day. Now I'll get emotional. And I was really nervous about today. Really nervous. Couldn't sleep last night. Was upset arguing with him about stuff. And then again, arguing with him. And then I had to stop back and go, why am I arguing with him? It's about me. I'm fearful. I have all this stuff going on inside. And I'm afraid to come here and share. Am I not going to say the right thing? Am I going to not be funny? He's the funny guy. I'm not the funny one. He's the funny one. I'm all serious. And, you know, I got to tell you how it is. And I'm the rule follower. And he's not. So, you know, it's funny. He's, you know... It is, we are just such opposites, but our oppositeness keeps us together because we communicate. You know, I'm real fortunate, again, because I have a sponsor that now when things go on in my life, I don't try and figure it out myself. I have to, and I say have to because it is have to. I have to call every morning or leave a text message, a voice text message, of my 10th step from the day before. And I say have to because she was on a month-long cruise, and if I didn't leave a message, I would get a text. I didn't get a message this morning, even while she was on a cruise. So, but see, that's what I need. I need somebody to keep me in check because I know how to play games. I know how to pretend. I know how to make you think everything's okay. But since I've had her for 14 years as a sponsor, she knows when I'm being self-pity, when I'm in self-pity, or when I'm, you know, being judgmental. I get to have somebody stop me and take a look at it and work through it and move on. I am so grateful for that. I am so grateful for that. I look back and think how I was before we ever stepped in these rooms. And again, you know, 40-some years in the program, and no one ever told me. I didn't work on me, trying to take care of myself, trying to be a better person. I can work everything I've learned, not just in our relationship, not just in a meeting, but in my everyday life. And for me, I need that. I need to know that I can go out, and all I want to be is a better person. And the only way I can be a better person is to work the steps, and I work them over and over. My sponsor now has me, we're doing the steps again, we're on step 6, and we're doing an AA drop the rock book. So we are, I mean, I don't know how to say that it's, you know, I'm not a counselor person. You know, when Nick passed, they were like, oh, you need to go to grief therapy, you need to, I'm like, no, I don't. I need to go to Al-Anon. I need to work with my sponsor. I get more from that than a guy sitting there going, And I've been to therapy, and I've walked away going, you don't know if I told you the truth or not. Yeah. For me, and I say that's only for me, because I can be honest with somebody when somebody's honest with me. When somebody shares and I can relate to it, it gives me an opportunity to share. And I've learned here that when I can share all that stuff that keeps me stuffing, it's not so bad anymore. What do they say in AA? It's like you have to be willing to be brutally honest. And if I keep stuff inside, oh, my life is horrible. My life is horrible because then I'm in my head. I'm having battles, I'm making things up, I'm thinking you looked at me the wrong way and you don't like me. You know, it's crazy what goes on in my head. And I've learned that, you know, that it's okay. I'm not crazy. I really thought I was a crazy person because it was really easy for me to be in a room like this and isolate and think like, oh, nobody likes me. Look, nobody came up to me and said hello. Well, guess what? I didn't go up to somebody and say hello either. I've really had to learn to step out, and I have to reach out with and give what I want. If I'm not willing to give it, I'm not going to get it. And again, I feel like I am so all over the place. I'm so sorry. But I just know that for me, you know, Al-Anon in these rooms is all about me taking care of myself. And I've learned that, you know, it is about progress, not perfection. I don't have to be perfect. And I don't have to try and do it all myself. I can ask for help. That's huge. You know, when Nick passed, I allowed people to help because my first mode is, I can take care of it. I can do it all. I'll do it. And all that does is allow me to avoid taking care of what's going on, because if I stay busy and I do things, then I don't have to look at what's going on inside. And there's always a lot going on inside of me. Always. Again, my problem is what's going on between my head. We have a member, and I always laughed. I love the expression. She says, getting into my head is a bad neighborhood. And when I go there, I get in a lot of trouble. It's a really bad neighborhood for me. Let's see. I'm not going to force a whole bunch more. you know, there's a few minutes left. I just want to, I am so grateful for the people that showed up. Dave and I, like, we didn't know what to expect. Mad Dog has been a great meeting for a convention. It's the very first convention I ever went to the first year I was here. So I have a lot of warm feelings for here. So I'm so grateful that you guys did this, and the committee, and our goodie basket and bag up in the room. And Brian, I love you. Brian called first. There's a lot of people I haven't seen in a while here. So just thanks for being here, and we love you.
Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12stepTapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12stepTapes.com for more information.